This week on Justified, the prequel, Raylan Givens is in charge of a small town, but when a military airline filled with a toxic agent crashes into the local water supply, he must jump to action.
I don't know what's going on right now, but my instant reaction is just to stand in front of a loaded gun and go, okay, let's just calm down.
This is Junk Food Cinema.
Hi, this is Dick Miller. You're listening to Junk Food Cinema on Film School Rejects. Who are these guys?
Welcome, psycho killers and padded cell fillers, to another sanity-bending episode of Junk Food Cinema. This is Film School Reject's weekly cult and exploitation film cast that is so good it just has to be fattening, and probably edited by the elves who live in our teeth while we sleep. I am your host, Brian Salisbury, again playing without a full deck, and I am joined by my co-host, my Harvey the Rabbit, my Tyler Durden, my Frank the Bunny. Yes, he's two different kinds of bunnies, novelist slash screenwriter, Mr. C. Robert Cargill.
Hi.
I like that every week I try to give you a more and more grandiose introduction, and your response is always, hi.
Hi.
Hi. That's hi. It. That's all you get. I want to remind you that that kind of grandiose intro and all of the other great content that we do here at Junk Food Cinema is available on iTunes. You can look us up there. You can look us up on Stitcher. You can follow us on Twitter at Junk Food Cinema. And you can like the podcast on Facebook, facebook.com/ you guessed it, you maniacs, Junk Food Cinema. Well, all month long, we at Junk Food Cinema have been gripped by a bad case of March Madness. No, we aren't talking about Cinderella programs or busting brackets. Instead, we're discussing our favorite lunatics, madmen, and wackos in cinema. You know what? We've been taking it easy on you guys so far, because we have been doling out the madness in single servings. Today, that fucking changes.
Double dose of crazy.
Double dose of crazy. We are engaging in our very first showdown episode, an exercise in which we will pit two similar but also very different films against one another in a bout of lunacy you can't even comprehend.
It's really not that much of a fight.
Yes, it's not.
It's really kind of a walloping.
That's true. And this one-sided bout, ladies and gentlemen, is crazy versus crazy, or rather, crazies versus crazy.
Crazy.
That's right. We are comparing and contrasting George A. Romero's 1973 cult hit The Crazies against the 2010 remake of the same name, because it's a remake of the same. But anyway, you get the point. You get the idea. So I guess we need to start at the beginning. We need to start in 1973 with the original, The Crazies.
The Crazies. Can they tame it before time runs out?
Now, this was made post Night of the Living Dead, but pre Dawn of the Dead.
Yeah, Romero still did not have big budgets. People still didn't give him the big cinematic shot that we feel he deserved, especially in this era. And so he churns out this super low budget movie called The Crazies. And it was a really cool idea. It was really playing on what was going on in the times. And it was a movie very of its time. It was a movie where, you know, keep in mind, this is 73. This is, you know,
the tail end of Vietnam.
It's tail end of Vietnam, Agent Orange, you know, everybody's afraid of the government. It's, you know, we're watching the collapse of Nixon. You know, this is a very troubled era in which we started really experiencing for the first time in this country a true distrust of government, a distrust that never really went away, that would lay dormant, you know, during certain administrations only to rear its ugly head again. But this is right before the height of it. This is right before all that really dark 70s cinema. So This was a little out of place in its time.
This is prior to 3 Days of the Condor, prior to Apocalypse Now, prior to the really murky, really nihilistic sort of anti-government, anti-military films that would come out of the 70s.
Prior to Last House on the Left.
Prior to Last House on the Left.
You know, the darkness that would overtake horror in that era. And this film, it was really interesting where it happened and what it played. And then it was really forgotten.
Yeah.
It was one of those movies that just kind of was something that hardcore film geeks and completists knew of, but wasn't really in the cultural mainstream. It, you know, Romero having made the Dead series, that both made his career and, ended up, casting a shadow on every other movie he made.
Yeah.
And everybody remembers him as, oh yeah, he's the guy that did all six of the Dead films. And it's like, yeah, and a bunch of other ones, some really good, some really not.
Have you seen Martin? but this is a departure.
Yeah, there's a bunch of people sitting out there right now going, wait, what the fuck are you talking about, Martin Thomas, like from Spill? Or?
We'll get to that.
Yeah.
We'll get to that sometime later. But this is a rare departure from our junk food cinema core values because I desperately dislike this movie. And from the beginning, I said that it was our goal to only talk about those movies that we liked. But I think it is crucial to discuss and dissect what the original got wrong so we can appreciate what the remake gets right. Because yes, my friends, this is one of the few examples of a remake surpassing the original film. But before we get to that, I want to talk about some of the reasons why this movie doesn't work for me. This is Romero's first, as Cargill said, it is super low budget, but keep in mind, it has a bigger budget than Night of the Living Dead had.
Yes.
And it's Romero's first union film. So this is technically the first time he's working within the bounds of, you know, the legalities and the rigors of what you're actually supposed to do as a professional filmmaker. And yet, with all of that being said, it feels more amateur than did Night of the Living Dead.
Oh, it's sloppy as hell. In terms of, in fact, I would argue that it's his sloppiest film.
I would agree with that.
It was a film that I hadn't seen until late in life. In fact, I didn't see it until the Romero-thon they had here in Austin. God, I want to say like 10 years ago, in which Romero came out and introed four of his movies. And I had seen all of them, but this one. So I was like, oh, hey, you know, I've heard about this movie for years. And then I watch it, and it's really underwhelming. It really is sloppy filmmaking early on. Like, it's one of those things that, you know, it highlights what was actually wrong with Night of the Living Dead that was so accidental. Because Night of the Living Dead has this very kind of handheld, almost right in the moment feel to it.
Yeah, almost like the first found footage film, you know, obviously not trying to capture that aesthetic, but you know, because it didn't exist.
Yeah.
But it has that feel to it. It has that very cinema verite kind of quality.
And because it was a movie that came out in 68 that was still in black and white, which was rare in those days.
Mm-hmm.
It still happened, but it was rare. It's one of those things that you forgive because you look at that and you see this aesthetic of this movie made on almost no money. And you just are amazed at what he does with that money. And then you see what he does when he has a little more money.
Mm-hmm.
And you're like, oh, he still has a ways to go. And sure enough, you know, we would end up with the polished filmmaker that would make Dawn of the Dead, which is still one of the greatest horror movies ever made.
Yeah.
You know, which makes top 20 lists, which most people cite as being better than Night of the Living Dead, despite just being the sequel.
But there's so much that should have worked.
Yes.
Given Romero, there's so much that the Crazies production shares in common with Night of the Living Dead's production. They filmed in a small town in Pennsylvania. The actors are mostly locals,
yeah.
Despite the fact that he was on a union shoot now. He's still using locals for the majority of this movie instead of real actors. And there's a lot of the same kind of camera work that's done here. There's a lot of like shots of people slowly walking across field. It should work the same way the Night of the Living Dead does. But it doesn't because of its structure, in my opinion.
Well, and I would argue it's that that's absolutely correct. I mean, the thing is with filmmaking like that, and it's something that independent and low budget filmmakers have learned time and again, is that sometimes when you take a gamble on locals and you just, you know, fly by the seat of your pants while you're making it, you make gold and you just come out as a guerrilla master. But you're really gambling,
mm-hmm.
and you're gambling on things that when they go wrong, they can go really wrong and they can torpedo your entire production. And I've seen a number of indie films have that problem where they do everything that these other filmmakers did. And, you know, one thing happens and another thing happens and it's dominoes and the entire film falls apart. And I've always felt that happened with Crazies, that Crazies was him repeating his formula and the formula not working. And that being the thing that probably kicked him in the ass that brought us to Dawn of the Dead. But yeah, no, its structure is really kind of wacky. Like, it's,
yeah.
it's really all over the map.
Well, it's okay. So the plot of Romero's Crazies, which is important to note because it's also going to be the plot of the remake that we talk about. So I'll just get it out of the way real quick. It's a small town that, because of a crashed military airplane carrying some questionable cargo, has its water supply infected by a virus that makes people go completely manic, and in most cases, violently so. So, I mean, that's the basic gist of it. But the movie, much like a sloppy open-faced sandwich, is divided into two parts. Story A is the military and government scientists struggle to contain the virus, quarantine the citizens, and, let's be honest, cover its own ass. And story B is about a group of survivors trying to stay uncontaminated while dodging the hazmat suit-clad soldiers who were ordered to shoot them on sight.
Yes.
So that's our structure. We have story A and story B. And the problem for me is they focus way, way, way too much on story A, and there is not enough time and effort put into story B.
Well, you know, it reminds me, the structure was borrowed for Cabin in the Woods, which most of you should be familiar with at this point. If you're not, fucking go out and watch Cabin in the Woods right now.
Seriously, it's on Netflix. Why yeah, haven't like, you watched like, it twice seriously. Already?
Yeah.
I'm watching it right now as we're recording.
But with Cabin in the Woods, they make sure that they have payoffs for both stories. And that's one of the problems I have with the Crazies is there is no really great payoff for story A, for the scientist and military story, you know, because you don't really feel for them because you realize they are the bad guys.
Yeah.
You know, and they've, you know, while they didn't necessarily cause this, they are responsible for all the awfulness that they have to do.
Yeah.
And Romero never really captures that because I feel like Romero doesn't sympathize with them.
Well, there's a tonal problem in general with this movie and the way that it approaches the military. But first, I mean, is it me or when you were watching this, did you think the military leapt to the nuke 'em all contingency really fucking quickly? Like, well, as soon as it was like someone sneezed, yes, let's wipe Evan City, Pennsylvania off the map. I was like, whoa, guys, like, try a plan A before you go to plan F.
The truth is, it's kind of the only option. Like, in retrospect, it's like, yeah,
but it's like,
probably that wasn't the dumb idea.
Right, but if that conversation had first happened like 3/4 of the way in, I would agree with you. But it's literally like, I think we have a virus here. Oh, nuke it from space. It's the only way to be sure. And it's
the
like,
only way to be sure.
Really? Already? That's what we're doing? You just sent the military in
which
here.
Which is where, you know, Dr. Strangelove comes in.
Because that's
where he's going. Like, he's continuing that conversation.
Yeah.
And the thing is, it's a conversation that didn't need to be continued because Kubrick kind of nailed it the first time.
Right. And put a pin in that because I've got some shit to say about that in just a minute. But one of the problems with this Crazies and the way that it's structured is that tonally, it's off its fucking rocker. I mean, there's a great line in this movie where one of the scientists says, "Christ, this is so random." And you know what? I agree, random scientist in this movie. There are edits where we literally cut to a new scene in the middle of a sentence. Somebody will be saying something and it'll smash cut to something completely, completely different. There's a scene where the military is slaughtering infected people, and that scene it should be intense, but it's made goofy by one infected woman who's got a broom, who's like trying to sweep up the battlefield, which looks completely like, it looks like Carol Burnett's little cartoon character from the opening of her show. And it's like, okay, well, I can't take this seriously. And then this is immediately followed. Immediately. There is no buffer. There is no fluffer. There is literally just this scene to a young boy crying as his mother is shot and then thrown on a fire. And then we cut immediately back to something goofy. And I'm like, what are you doing? I don't understand what movie you want to be. Romero, I don't understand what you're doing, and I think it's a movie with no idea what it wants to be, and we have a couple of theories on that. The first one, and we'll get to the second one, which Cargill already alluded to, but the first one is the script rewrite. This movie, The Crazies, is based on a script called The Mad People by Paul McCullough.
Which just doesn't have the same ring.
No, it doesn't. The Mad People, The Crazies, we're going with The Crazies. I get it.
I am angry. This plane has crashed. It has made me upset.
I am
honk, honk.
I am a mad person. Yeah, no, I get it. I get it, Hollywood. You win on that one. But the script dealt with a military bioweapon accidentally released in a small town, the military trying to cover it up, and, you know, the townspeople revolting. Okay, that's cool. But Romero disliked this script. It was brought to him by a producer, and it was like, we should make this. but you should rewrite it. And sure enough, Romero disliked the script because the military subplot was only featured in the first act. And then the rest of the film focused on the survivors as they try to cope with what was happening. And Romero called McCullough's script very existential and heady. So instead, he made something not existential and stupid and focused way more on the military. It's like the biggest overcompensation I've ever seen in a script rewrite, where it's like, I don't like the fact that there's not enough military. So now the movie is entirely about the military.
Yep.
And I think that that completely throws it off balance. And, you know, like I said, he focuses way too much on the military. Now, part two of this theory is Dr. Crazylove, or sorry, Dr. Strangelove.
Dr. Crazylove.
I remember the first time I saw this movie. It was a few years ago, and I was deep into my, I want to consume every cult film I've never seen before. I had just moved to Austin, and I was throwing myself at my local video store, Vulcan Video, here in Austin, Texas. And
as seen on Jimmy Kimmel.
As seen on Jimmy Kimmel, so they don't need free plugs from me, but I'm going to do it anyway. So I sat down to watch The Crazies, and I kept thinking of Dr. Strangelove. And to this day, that's what I believe Romero was doing, is he made The Crazies as his political satire that is far more interested in mocking military bureaucracy than it is developing a frightening or even remotely tense horror story.
Yeah.
That's what we've got going on here. We've got Romero's weird version of Dr. Strangelove, right down to the fact that Johnny Comes Marching Home Again underscores a lot of scenes in this movie that it really should not be underscoring.
Well, you know, I've always felt that this movie aspired to a greatness that it did not have the potential to achieve. And that's exactly what you're saying. I mean, I felt it in a very kind of different way. I just felt Romero wanted to, it was very scattershot, and he wanted to do too many things at once. And he just doesn't hit any of the marks properly. The thing is that the concept of that story was so good, and it was such an interesting concept, that it would then be stolen, ripped off later, and become a trope. You know, the idea of the military plane crashing with the content in it. Gee, that sounds a little familiar to another classic Romero ripoff movie called Return of the Living Dead, where they merged the of the dead movies with the conceit of the crazies and created a zombie movie out of both.
I care more about Linnea Quigley's left nipple than I do any of the characters in this movie. Okay. I'm just going to throw that out there.
She's kind of a beautiful woman.
Even if she wasn't, I would still care more about Linnea Quigley's left nipple than I do any of the characters in The Crazies, because yes, they don't try to develop them.
They don't. And this is one of the set, this is probably the saddest 15, 20 minutes of junk food cinema ever, because it's really us kicking a movie by a filmmaker we adore. Because we need to talk about it in order to get to the real meat of this episode.
Yes.
Which
yes.
is one of the best horror remakes of all time.
Which, you know, I want to say one more thing. There's even a moment at the 74-minute mark of Romero's The Crazies where he rips off Kubrick's editing, where he literally snap cuts back and
forth. It's an homage.
No. It's theft. Where he snap cuts back and forth between the two generals and then immediately to a bomber in the sky. And I'm just like, and the whole thing is, fine, you want to pay homage, you want to tip your cap, that's great. But don't do it at the expense of the weight of your story.
Yeah.
The first time we hear Johnny Comes Marching Home Again is when a woman goes, oh yeah, that farmer burned down his house and murdered his wife and severely burned his kids. I'm like, are we supposed to laugh at that? What the fuck are you doing?
Well, keep in mind that early on, that was very much what Romero was going for. You know, Romero thought Night of the Living Dead was a comedy.
He might be insane. Might be the maddest person we've talked about yet, and
Keep in mind that John Woo thought The Killer was a comedy as well, and in Hong Kong, it was a comedy, but over here, we're just like, oh my God, this is so depressing.
But Romero can't use that excuse. He's from here.
I'm aware of this fact, but... No, he was making comedy horror. He thought stuff was funny. And I think the fact that he made that homage makes me think that he was really aspiring to be a low budget Kubrick, that he really wanted to think he could do something serious and funny at the same time, which he can. And he did. I mean, ultimately, he did that with Dawn of the Dead and Day of the Dead, and depending on, you know...
Choke on it! Choke on it!
Pick your random of the dead film. I happen to be in a very rare camp where I love all six movies.
All six. Including Diary.
Including Diary.
You are an interesting and unique
Land.
Snowflake.
I love
okay, Survival. I actually like Land. I can't give you shit for that. I will give you shit for Diary, but I can't give you shit for Land.
I really enjoy Diary. I mean, I seriously, Romero...
You know he's not listening, right? You can honest.
I do know that I'm that weird guy. You know, Romero...
I've been telling you that for years.
The thing is sometimes there are those guys who do stuff that just doesn't work for everybody, but you know, they sit there and they go, yeah, but I'm doing it for the fans that appreciate my voice. When it comes to Romero, I'm right there with his voice, and that's what pains me so much with the Crazies, is because I want to love the Crazies, because I love Romero's work. I think he is mostly great. Mm-hmm. You know, he's had a few misses, and I think this is his biggest miss, because it's such a great idea, and there's some really interesting scenes in this movie. There's some really good moments, but the movie overall just doesn't totally work, and never did, mm-hmm. and was always just... a peculiarity in his career. Yeah. And so when we heard that someone was remaking The Crazies, it was like, oh, yes, that's one of those perfect movies to remake. It's much like how you and I feel about Man on Fire, where there's really, you know, it's a really interesting misfire that had a great idea that could lead to a great movie and then did.
Wow, you know what I just realized? I thought this was the first time we've ever done a Showdown episode.
No, it's not.
Man, I'm glad you are
we
the
did
archivist.
Man on Fire versus Man on Fire.
I'm glad you're the archivist of this show. Oh, wait a minute. No, that's me, and I still can't remember shit.
I'm not the I can't remember people's names. How am I supposed to archive shit? The only reason That's I still point. Have a career is because my wife manages the daytime stuff. I barely can keep my head on straight.
That makes
sense.
You
put a mic in front of me, I can talk for like 6 hours, but you put paperwork in front of me and it's like, I'll fill it out in 3 weeks.
We've recorded 30 years worth of episodes already. I've just, you know, Cargill drinks a six pack of beer. I put the microphone in his face and we have 30 years worth of episodes now. It's pretty incredible.
It just happens.
It just happens. But I want to say this though. I don't feel bad about kicking the Crazies. Because for some reason, when that Blu-ray came out a few years ago, people came out of the woodwork to defend this movie. The word brilliant, I read in a lot of reviews of the Blu-ray about the movie. And not the color, not brilliant color in the high-def transfer, but brilliant in terms of the story. And I'm just like...
And a handful of those people might be listening now and being like, oh, guys, you're so wrong on this movie.
No. You are wrong. And I am not the kind of person who routinely says that about opinions on film. You are wrong. This movie is a fucking mess. And that
I'm not going to call it a fucking mess.
It's a fucking mess.
I will call it a misfire.
Yes, like a missile that misfires and nukes an entire town.
I think it kind of misses the town, but it was a near miss. Like, it's not that, but it doesn't make me angry to watch it. But it's seriously, hands down, if you say, hey, we're going to watch The Crazies tonight, I'm going to go, oh, the one with Timothy Oliphant, right?
Yeah, but you know what? You may not hate it, but you got to admit it's tough to sit through.
It's not an easy film to sit through. It's
almost 2 hours long. It is an hour and 48 minutes long, and there's no reason this movie should be an hour and 48 minutes long.
Well, it was a different time.
No, it's just a bad movie.
There is
no caveat. There's no qualifier. It's just a bad movie.
There's some really good elements to it.
Look, I gave you Diary. Yes. You can't do this to me now. Okay? You can't backpedal on this.
If you're going
to
give me Diary, I'll back off on this.
I let the record show that I give you Diary of the Dead, but don't you dare start backpedaling on the Crazies. It's a fucking mess, misfire, whatever M qualifier you want to use.
You guys can hear him steamrolling me, right? Okay, good.
Must feel different for you to be on the other end of the...
No, I'm quite used to this. I just don't make a big show of it usually.
Listen to him. All right, so here's the thing about Cargill and I is, you know, even among like our critic friends, I think we're two of the guys who don't hate on remakes when it comes to horror films.
No.
Like, in fact,
like back in the day when you started doing some work for Spill, mm-hmm. And there was talk of bringing you on to do the occasional review, I pulled Corey aside and said, you have to have him on. And
he's like, insane.
And he's like, why do I have to have him on? It's like, because he's a lot like me. He disagrees with you guys on the basic principles of what he wants in a movie. And that argument and that discussion leads to what can make great reviews. Like some of our best reviews back in the days are the ones, not that we all agreed on and just had a slam dunk contest on a movie, the ones where we wildly differed from each other. And I'm like, now that I'm gone and I'm off doing these other things, you need someone you disagree with. And that's Brian. And you and I, we both accept remakes for what they are. Now, we both agree on the basic tenets. Mm-hmm. You do not remake a perfect movie.
No.
Remaking a perfect movie is just trying to cash in on a perfect movie. The idea of a remake should always be, we're going to take a film that is good or mediocre, but has a great nugget and could be a great movie and make something that is better than the original. You don't remake Casablanca. You don't remake Jaws. You don't remake E.T. What you do is you find a movie like The Crazies or a movie like Man on Fire where you're like, oh, that's such a good idea, but they just didn't quite nail it. And then you go, how do we nail this?
Yeah.
And with Man on Fire, it's you focus on the relationship, the father-daughter relationship between, you know, the hired gun and the neglected daughter. How do you do it in The Crazies? You cut out the military altogether and you focus on the people stuck in the town with no idea what the fuck is going on.
I have to believe that the writers on the remake, the 2010 remake of The Crazies...
We're in trouble.
David, there's somebody outside.
Military started shooting town folk.
We gotta get out of here, guys!
The writers read McCullough's original script because it seems like they knew exactly what was wrong with the original film and they sought to correct that. Now, I also want to say that we are not the only people to draw the connect. I mean, it's as plain as, you know, an atom bomb being dropped on your head, the connection between The Crazies and Dr. Strangelove. But what I really love is the way that they pay homage to that weird choice by Romero to go in that route. The opening song of The Crazies, 2010, is a Johnny Cash cover of We'll Meet Again. Now, you might remember, Cargill, I don't know if you're infected yet. Your memory's still, we're not infected, right?
We're not infected.
We're not infected. Okay. The end.
We're not infected, right?
We're not infected. No, we're not infected, right? We're not. The end of Dr.
Strangelove.
We're not infected. The end of Dr. Strangelove is, as the bombs are dropping, we hear this beautiful rendition of a song called We'll Meet Again.
We'll meet again. Don't know where. Don't know where. But I know.
And it's pure Johnny Cash, there's a handful of movies.
Well, I was talking about the Dr. Strangelove
one, right.
And then The Crazies opens with this awesome cover by Johnny Cash.
Because in the 2000s, we had Johnny Cash covers of stuff that was fucking awesome.
Well, and in fact, you know, that's a good point, because IMDb tried to explain this away by saying the reason that that's the song that was chosen is because a Johnny Cash song was also chosen to open the Dawn of the Dead remake, another Romero remake. And I'm like, no, bullshit. That's not the reason
Johnny Cash was used at the beginning of half a dozen films in the 2000s.
But this song specifically was chosen because of that weird connection between the original Crazies and Dr. Strangelove. Yeah. And in fact, at one point during the film, again, like a lot of the events that happen in the original do happen in the remake, but they are told from a wildly different perspective and one that makes the movie so much more likable and so much more engaging for the audience. One of the things that happens in the same way is that there is a character who burns down his house and, you know, hurts his family. And when they've arrested that guy, instead of speaking a single word, he just starts whistling when Johnny comes marching home again. So again, like, there is no coincidence here.
Yeah.
They absolutely knew what Romero was trying to do with The Crazies. Now, they don't try and emulate that by any stretch of the imagination. I mean, this is a straight-up horror film.
It's a straight-up survival horror film.
Yes, absolutely.
And a well-acted, great-casted survival film.
Yeah.
The thing is The Crazies has been kind of nestled into a small little, it's almost its own little forgotten film. It is easily one of the best remakes of the last two decades. It was well liked when it came out. Critics liked it. Audiences liked it. It did well at the box office. You know, it was the type of film that should have made a big cultural impact and then just kind of left the conversation. And if you mention The Crazies, people kind of vaguely remember and go, oh yeah, no, I remember liking that movie. And I was that way too, because, you know, I've always dug that movie. I've seen it a couple of times. And then again, I'm one of the few people on the Breck Eisner train. I think Breck Eisner is probably one of the best unrecognized directors working today. But then again, you hate his first film, Sahara.
I really dislike Sahara.
I love Sahara, Sahara, and I love The Crazies. And he is a man, he's a director who has the heart of a junk food cinephile. Do you remember what movie he was trying desperately to make? He has not made another movie since. He tried to desperately to make a movie after The Crazies. He used all the juice from The Crazies to make a movie, to make a remake. What movie was that?
The Last Witch Hunter? Or I Know What You Did Last Summer.
No.
Because he's in...
Those are the things he's in production on.
Yeah.
He tried for years to make Flash Gordon.
Ah, nice.
He loves Flash Gordon. He loves the original comics. He loves the movie. He is one of us. And these are, both of these movies show it, and I feel it. And this is where I strongly depart from you. I think you're wrong on Sahara. I think Sahara is a very funny.
I think you're just blinded by abs. I think that's
no, the no. I mean, I do love my McGenre, hey, but, but I do, no, but Eisner was really super smart here. He knew that he was one of those directors that he knew he was fighting for his career. Sahara didn't perform the way they thought it would. You know, it was coming from a series that was a New York Times best-selling series by one of those best-selling authors of all time kind of people, Clive Cussler, and everybody thought it would be huge with McConaughey, and it wasn't. And
yeah.
And so he was fighting for his life with this movie. And every choice that I see him making in this movie is similar to the way I saw Scott Derrickson make similar choices on Sinister, where Scott just knew that this could be the last movie of his career, his previous film had not delivered, that he was always coming in second and third place in meetings now because of mistakes that were made by other people, but ultimately fell on him. And so Eisner attacked this film like it would be his last. Mm-hmm. And boy, how did he get every single moment right?
I gotta say, I can cut this out if you don't want me to mention this, but there is a moment in this movie, in this remake of The Crazies, that I'm pretty sure influenced you in a certain script that you just wrote.
No, but in rewatching it, I was like, holy shit, actually, wow.
Okay, as long as you saw it.
Yeah, no, I saw it, and I was like, wow, you know, that never crossed my mind. But yeah, no, there's a moment in there that, yeah, they did it before we did it in Sinister, so it was kind of like, oh, okay, wait, no, hold on one second.
Now, I'm talking about one that has not been, or is in the process of being in production.
Oh, no.
Really?
No, I had no idea that.
All right, well, we'll talk about that off mic.
Yeah, but yeah, we'll talk about that later.
But I think...
You know, the moment you're talking about, the moment that keyed up with me was... In Sinister, we've got the scene where, the actress Claire Foley, you know, the daughter in the movie is dragging an axe,
mm-hmm.
and she's,
the pitchfork
and the pitchfork. And I was watching the pitchfork and I'm like, oh shit, this is probably where I got this idea.
That is a great scene.
It's a really great scene. In fact, such a great scene that it became the poster of the movie, where the poster was just this pitchfork next to a foot. And it's like, what the fuck is that? But I have to fucking see it.
Yeah.
And, but yeah, no, this, I feel like every beat in this movie works. And I love that this is a movie about character choices, and it's a movie about developing characters in a fucked up situation. And it's got such great, strong, simple dialogue. Like, the dialogue in this movie is not complex, but the dialogue in this movie is interesting.
I would say it's quaint.
It is, but there's...
Because I'm not saying that it's small-minded or anything, but it does feel very folks. It feels very homey. Like, everything they say... I mean, you've got Timothy Oliphant playing the small-town sheriff with that same kind of, like, amiable, brash swagger of, like, James Brolin in The Car.
Or like Raylan Givens in Justified.
Yeah, I was
like,
yeah.
It really is kind of a precursor. That's why we did the cold open the way we did. Because really, when going back to watch this after you watch Justified, you're just like, Oh, this is young Raylan Givens.
Yeah.
Because it really is. Like, he's falling back on a lot of his same acting tricks.
Yeah.
To do
Like again, the first thing he has to encounter is a guy with a loaded gun, and his reaction is to walk up and go, hey, man, let's calm down.
And he draws the gun before you even see it. It's just like,
I just described every episode of Justified.
Yeah,
there is that scene in almost every episode of Justified.
But you know what? I really, one of the things that impresses me, especially as a screenwriter, is how wonderfully they get us into that scene, because there's only maybe four or five lines of dialogue before that scene happens.
Mm-hmm.
But we already feel like we're in the town.
Yeah.
Like, cause it's, he walks up and they slide a cup of coffee in front of him. You know, the principal walks up and says, oh, no, sheriff never pays for coffee. And he picks up the coffee. Says, thanks. Principal still has to pay for his, parking tickets though.
Yeah.
And he walks off, and then the principal turns and goes, run the sheriff a tap. And then they go and they watch, and we're watching baseball, and the guy walks out. We already feel invested in this town and this sheriff in three mm-hmm. fucking lines of dialogue.
Yeah.
And it's so good. And then we get to that great line, my favorite line in this movie, a line that it's just one of those lines that's so fucking good. I'm jealous as a writer that it's somebody else wrote it, but it's this line where, he's talking to this guy about where their wives have been taken. And the two guys, both of their wives have been taken because they have elevated temperatures. They've been taken to where they're taking all the crazies. And Timothy Oliphant's just like, I've got to go to this high school. I got to get my wife out. And he's like, man, it's not worth it. Just go. The military will take care of it. And then Timothy Oliphant says,
don't ask me why I can't leave without my wife. And I won't ask you why you can.
Yeah. And it's just like,
brilliant.
It's just like, fuck. Like, it tells you so much about who that guy is. That one line mm-hmm. tells you, cause up until that, it's so weird. Cause up until that point, they don't lean heavily on the relationship as most scripts do. Like, you know, it's a very common, you know, there's a common, phrase that's called, in screenwriting called saving the cat. Where you have a character do something good that ends up getting you invested in them. And there's a variant of that in which you do that for relationships. You have to have this sweet, tender moment that shows the audience just how much one character loves the other. And I remember I had, there was a script I was working on where the studio was leaning on us really hard to give them a more profound moment between these characters. They're like, look, we need to get them outside of this locale where this thing happens. And we have to have them have a tender moment so that the audience buys into their relationship. And this movie doesn't have that. And while you're watching it, you notice that this couple they're just a married couple. And looking at it structurally as a writer, you're like, oh, how are we going to get invested in these characters? And I had totally forgotten about that line. And then that line comes and it's like, boom. Mm. And suddenly that then leads us to a scene, you know, half an hour later where they're at an abandoned truck stop and they just lean across the table and kiss passionately. And you're like, yes, these two people are fucking madly in love. Of course they are. Like, why would anybody doubt that? And the thing is, it's truly clever, smart writing by screenwriters who know exactly what the fuck they're doing. And
by one of the screenwriters, by the way, is the guy who wrote The Machinist.
Yeah, there
which
you go.
Should tell you a lot right there. And I want to say that yes, all of those details, all those finite details are very much present, and they're very much at the heart of what makes the characters work. But really what we're talking about is the simple choice to take the structure of the original and completely flip it over so that instead of focusing on the military, you focus on the people coping with the contagion and the horrific qualities of those infected, which accomplishes three things immediately. First, it makes us care far more about these characters than we did anyone in the tone-deaf original. Second, it actually allows the scary bits to be scary. There's nothing scary about the original. And three, it actually builds a mystery. Now, if you've seen the original film, there is no mystery.
No.
But the way that the remake is structured, you don't have those conversations with the generals 5 minutes in, so you don't know everything that's going on.
No.
So there are moments of discovery throughout the film.
And the truth is, we spend exactly two scenes with the military. Only two do we encounter the military in any way, shape, or form. And both of those give us just the amount of information we need to know and get the same sense of what Romero grasped at in all of those fucking scenes in the original.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, we have these two scenes. One scene is with a young, you know, I'm guessing he's, National Guard, but probably not because he has no idea what state he's in, as he says, until they saw the license plates. And he just doesn't know what the fuck's going on. They just know that if they've been told that if they take their masks off, they're going to die mm-hmm. and they're going to get sick and die and, that everyone is infected. And so, you know, and there's this great scene between, Timothy Oliphant and this young guy where Timothy Oliphant just decides to trust this guy. Mm-hmm. And he's like, and the guy's like, look, we didn't sign up to shoot unarmed civilians. That's not what we do. And it does a great job of painting exactly the confusion that's existing in the military right now. Right. And the point that Romero was trying to make. And then later on, we have this other moment with this kind of top end guy, as his car is blown off of the road. And he's just like, look, we're trying to help you. Look, yeah. You don't understand what's going on here. You don't know how bad this is. And we get all of that sense of confusion and madness and what's fucked up about all of it without ever having to spend time with the scientists sitting there dicking around with it. Yeah. So we get to spend time only with Timothy Oliphant and the crew that he assembles of people he's trying to get out of town. And it's just so well done.
See, this is why you should never cling to the idea that remakes are always inferior, because in two scenes, the remake is able to get across better the point that Romero failed to make over 148 minutes or an hour and 48 minutes with the original.
Now, that doesn't mean that you or I support all remakes.
No.
We support the idea of the remake for movies that warrant it.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I want to talk about a cinematography choice in this movie that I didn't notice until this viewing, but really, really had me interested. Tight shots.
Oh, yeah.
An overwhelming majority of the shots in this movie are filmed from very close range. I mean, even the shot, there was a shot that was a centerpiece in the trailer of this crowd breaking through a fence of a containment center and running out. I mean, it was the big shot in the trailer. That shot we see from the female protagonist's perspective and through a small window. So even that shot is really tight. And what it does is it assists. First of all, it assists in setting up some of the jump scares.
Yes.
So on a pragmatic level, I understand that. But it also builds tension by forcing the audience to reside in this constant state of dis-ease. And plus, a lot of the scares in this film aren't jump scares.
No.
So it even builds up and helps with the scares that are more... I mean, these are moments where you can't believe the movie is forcing you to sit there and watch this horrible thing as it unfolds in front of your eyeballs.
Oh, you're talking about the best scene in this movie, right?
I think I am.
You're talking about the car wash scene.
I'm going to get to the car wash scene in just a minute, but I think
to focus on the cinematography. The cinematography in this film is amazing.
Because even though it's really tight,
It's
not jerky. It's like every shot is beautifully composed.
It is.
It's just really close.
It is elegant, not showy. Mm-hmm. It is not, look at these dramatic vistas. It is, you know, it is very clever in how it does it. You're right about all the close-up stuff, but just in the way they set stuff up, there are a couple of shots that just are just masterful. Like that shot we talked about with dragging the pitchfork. The shot where we see the gas mask come down over the doctor, the wife, Rhoda Mitchell. And we see her reflection up in the goggles as she's terrified. And there's this faceless thing staring down at her. I love the fact that they do these great shots. They have these several great shots of just this nice, empty, quiet town. And then they choose the exact same angle after all hell is broken loose to show us that nice, quiet, you know, dead town with everything on fire. And it's just, it's so elegant the way they do everything. It's not in your face. It's not big and grandiose. It's just beautiful and well done and tells this story in such a good way.
And ask yourself this question. What are the only really wide shots in the whole movie? They're from the satellite where the military is keeping tabs on everybody.
Except for their big centerpiece shot at the end.
True.
You know, they have two centerpiece shots at the end, one looking back at town and one looking ahead. But most of their big shots are of roads.
Yeah.
And which is, you know, because this whole movie is about these four people trying to get out of this,
and
this small town.
It's a great way to illustrate desolation, you know, yeah. to show a raw. I mean, like, look at George Miller's films, for God's sake.
Oh, yes. No, and I think that, I mean, come on. Tell me that shot of them walking down the road, the three of them walking down the road towards the end of the movie, that wasn't the way they framed that wasn't taken from Mad Max.
Yeah, no, I think it absolutely is. And I also think that the cinematographer, whose name is Maxime Alexander, must have seen Romero's film and noticed that so much of what could have even possibly passed for horror was diffused by so many wide shots that makes for a very passive, non-engaging visual signature. Like, it's just, everything's just so meandering.
Yeah.
And it starts with the just plant the camera and point it. And that's, again, and it's funny to me too, because this cinematographer also shot The Hills Have Eyes and Maniac Remake, as well as High Tension. So he's really Alexander Aja's favorite cinematographer. But yes, going back to that car wash, because that car wash scene, though.
The car wash is that is.
Oh, that car wash scene, though.
That is probably one of the 10 best horror scenes of the last decade and a half.
Because first of all, we've never seen anything like it.
No.
Like, no one has ever used a car wash in that fashion. I mean, like, you think about a car wash, it's very claustrophobic. Like, a lot of people with claustrophobia have issues with car washes, because not only are you...
And people who love tight spaces love car washes, because yes. They're just like, I'm trapped in my car and I can't see shit and this is awesome.
Yes, all of your vision is obscured by, you know, various brushes and spinny things, and people stuck in a car, you know, it's so tense. And again, those tight shots really work for it, but I love the fact that they don't... They use a little bit of dark humor in this scene that really makes it work. One of my the deputy says, "Oh my god, I saw a movement," and Oliphant replies, "Everything is fucking moving," because they're on a conveyor belt.
Yes,
so he's like, "Yes, I know, everything is fucking moving." And then you think, I mean, right when you think they're out, right when you think everything is done, is when they pull the rug out from under you in one of the most brutal, brilliant fashions I've ever seen, and I love it so much.
Yeah. No, it everything in that scene is effective, but I think it's made more effective by something we haven't really highlighted, in that what really works for this movie is how well acted it is.
Oh, absolutely.
Like, the cast in this movie, it's not a big name cast, but everybody who's in it are high end character actors. Even the small bits are played by character actors. You're like, oh, that's that guy from that thing in that one movie. And this whole movie's full of them. Mm-hmm. And your big names are that guy from that thing. You know, you've got Timothy Oliphant, you got Rhoda Mitchell, and you've got Danielle Pennebaker. And then there's the guy whose name I always forget, who's never really hit, but is really good, who plays the deputy.
Joe Anderson.
Yeah, Joe Anderson. All four of them fucking bring it to this movie. They act like this is the last movie they are ever going to be in. Like, they, none of them phone this in. And Danielle Pennebaker, somebody I've always loved, who I don't think has ever really gotten her due.
Well, I think she is now because of the Flash, Green Arrow shows.
Yeah, like, but she's getting her due as a TV actor, as opposed to, like, she's done some really great film work in the past.
But you gotta admit, like, when somebody achieves that level of TV success, sometimes it does encourage people to go back and see what they've done before, yes. So you know, and I can't really begrudge her having TV success. No,
but I feel that she's an incredibly talented actress that should probably be doing more films, but I'm glad she's doing The Flash.
I mean, Joe Anderson, for example, took over for Michael Pitt on Hannibal as Mason Verger.
Yes.
So, I mean, TV is where a lot of, I mean, it's the paradigm is shifting, and we can talk about that all day, but we can't.
Yes. But the thing is that all four of these actors go all out and really Agreed. Bring it. And the writing in this script is so smart. It really does create a number of different radical characters in this movie that the only times they make crazy decisions, you know, the only times they endanger everyone else are for things that you're like, well, of course, you know, when Danielle Pennebaker goes running off towards the house, you're just like, what the fuck? And it's like, dude, that's her boyfriend's house. And it's like, she's a 17-year-old girl and that's her boy. Of course she's going to fucking run off and check that her boyfriend's okay. And all the stuff all the drama that unfolds from that sequence.
Yeah.
Every character is properly defined. Like, it's none of them are just horror movie tropes. They're real characters. Mm-hmm. This is a small town sheriff who cares more about saving the people of his town background than he cares about his own job. We learned that in the first like 20 minutes of the fucking movie. You know, his deputy is a guy who's really cocksure and sure of himself, but, you know, also knows his place and is the deputy to what he knows is a good man.
Well, they keep doing that interaction over and over again of like, who's the sheriff? Who's the deputy?
Yeah.
Deputy does what the sheriff says. Yeah. And of course, Yeah, exactly. Who rules Bartertown?
Yeah.
Timothy Oliphant.
Who rules Bartertown? Master Blaster.
I have a theory as to why this movie hasn't really gotten its due. Is that 2010, both for smaller independent foreign and blockbuster horror, was a damn good year.
It was.
We got Bedeviled, Insidious, Let Me In, which is actually another great remake, Cold Fish, The Crazies, obviously. I Saw the Devil. Frozen came out that year. Black Death. I mean, there's
but all the movies you're naming are movies us cinephiles have seen.
That's exactly
nobody,
what I said.
Nobody heard in the mainstream.
If it's both the independent stuff and it's the mainstream stuff. Tucker and Dale versus Evil had mainstream success. Monsters was in mainstream theaters. You know, and so I mean, I think it was just a really good year for horror. And I think because it came out in February of that year, The Crazies is just one of those movies that people forgot about. Yeah. And I'm here to tell you again, guys, don't sleep on The Crazies because it's so fucking good.
No, this is a really legitimately great movie. It is probably one of those really great go-to, like, I want to kick back and drink a few beers and watch a good frightening movie that works. In the past few years, this is one of those. This is one of the very best.
Absolutely.
And it's one that you don't regularly see in top tens. When people talk about like top 10 horror of the 2000s, people don't list The Crazies, and they really fucking should, because it is far and away better than a lot of the other stuff. And it's such a great concept. I mean, the concept that blows my mind about how good this concept is just the notion that you have two villains in this movie.
You do, yeah.
You have people who are sick and losing their fucking minds, and then you have the military. And they're both equally scary in different ways.
And they're both framed in similar ways.
Yes.
For scares, they're both framed in similar ways.
Yeah, and the thing is you in survival horror, these people are pitted bowling right down the middle of these two, caught between these two terrible things. And then it's got just such a bleak ending. It's just like, oh, fuck me. That ending is just so hard.
Yeah.
And in the best way possible. It's just, it's really fucking good.
And if you don't, after listening to this episode, go back and watch this film, you know what word I would use to describe you? Do you want to take a guess as to what word I would describe you?
Limp?
Yeah, limp.
Is he dead?
Well, that brings us, of course, to the junk food pairing. And for this week, I had to do it. You knew it was going to happen eventually.
Open face sandwich?
No, I went with crazy bread.
Okay, yes!
Yes.
Because I have no qualms with that choice, sir.
It is a rare week. Look, when Little Caesars opened up shop in Garden City, Michigan in 1959, they weren't the first restaurant serving pizza pie. In fact, pizza pie, which is what it was called then, was popularized in America after World War II by GIs who brought it back from Italy. They were, however, the first pizza joint to be carry-out only with no tables in the storefront. They also didn't invent the breadstick, which had been an appetizer at Italian restaurants for years, but much like the 2010 remake of The Crazies, they improved upon a standard when they introduced crazy bread. They topped their bread with butter and garlic flavors and then sprinkled Parmesan cheese on top in a combo so good, yes, it was crazy. And for many years after, and to this day, other chains have tried to remake that recipe, and there is an argument to be made for Pizza Hut's breadstick remake being a worthy usurper. But no, still reigning supreme in this case is, in fact, crazy bread, your junk food pairing for Crazies versus Crazies. And that's going to do it for the show this week. Thank you so much for joining us. I want to remind you yet again that you can find Junk Food Cinema on iTunes as well as on Stitcher. You can also follow us on Twitter at Junk Food Cinema and like the podcast on Facebook, facebook.com/Junk Food Cinema. Cargo, where can people find you on the internet?
You can find me on Twitter at twitter.com. Slash Massaworm, that's MASSAWYRM, or on Facebook.com, on Facebook.com/Massaworm.
And you can find me on Twitter at BryGuySalisbury. You can also find me on Facebook, Facebook.com/BryanSalisburyCritic. And you can go over to my home away from home, oneofus.net. Lots of great blogs and podcasts over there, as well as our first official sponsor, audible.com. So go over there and click the link that we have all over that page to get yourself a free audiobook. But yeah, that's going to do it for this week's madness. We will have one final, one grand finale of lunacy that will top off March Madness next week. And I'm sure you guys are anxious to hear what that is. And I hazard to say, one of you out there may have heard of it.
Okay.
It's definitely a lost gem.
We have both seen it.
We have both seen it.
Beforehand, this is not a new one for either of us.
No.
But so few people have seen it, I think it's worth talking about.
Very much so. But again, that's the end of the show. So for Cargill, this is Brian signing off. Until we meet again, next week.
We'll meet again. Don't know where. Don't know when. But I know we'll meet again some sunny day.